I'm pressing on. I'm pressing on.
Welcome to another Bible study brought to you by the Hamilton Church of Christ. In 1 Corinthians 10, verse 21, you cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of devils. You cannot be partakers of the Lord's table and of the tables of devils. What the Apostle Paul is telling Christians here is that they cannot participate in true worship to God and false worship to anything other than God. That would be the cup of the devil or the table of the devil. So we have to be sure that our worship is correct and not mingle or mix it with other worship that is not from God. We invite you to join us today as we study the Bible.
When clouds of doubt arise, spreading across the skies, travel along with courage, singing a song.
Be faithful,
Jesus, let's smooth your rod, lighten your heavy load. Look on the brighter side. Look on the brighter side, yes. Look on the brighter side.
Shadows will pass away.
We'll sing with gladness,
trust in the Lord to guide you.
Trust
in the Lord to guide you. Surely He'll keep you every day.
Away your sadness
when you are bending low, yes. When you are bending low, live as your life be time.
Almost lose your courage.
The shadows are lifting, the dark clouds are lifting. Look on the brighter side. To dread, the skies are just ahead. Travel along
with courage,
singing a song.
Be faithful,
sunlight will soon break through, shining in splendor new. Look on the brighter side,
the brighter side.
Look on the brighter side, yes. Look on the brighter side. The shadows will pass away,
and your heart will sing with gladness. Trust in the Lord to guide you.
Trust in the Lord to guide you,
surely He'll keep you every day.
Away your sadness
when you're bending low, yes. When you're bending low,
leave
as your life be time.
Almost lose your courage.
The shadows are lifting, the dark clouds are lifting. Look on the brighter side.
Sing with gladness,
trust in the Lord to guide you.
Trust in the Lord to guide
you. He'll keep you every day.
Away your sadness
when you're bending low, yes. low, even as your life betrays. The shadows are lifting, the dark clouds are lifting, look on the brighter side.
Our study continues in the 6th chapter of Genesis. We are ready to begin in the 22nd verse. But first of all, let's go back and read verses 19, 20, and 21, because here are the instructions that God gives to Noah. He says, "And of every living thing of all flesh, two of every sort shalt thou bring into the ark, to keep them alive with thee. They shall be male and female, of fowls after their kind, and of cattle after their kind, and of every creeping thing of the earth after his kind. Two of every sort shall come unto thee, to keep them alive. And take thou unto thee of all food that is eaten, and thou shalt gather it to thee, and it shall be for food for thee and for them." So Noah had a big job to do. He'd been working on this ark for some 100 years now, and he'd been a preacher of righteousness all this time. These sons and their families to know the truth. So verse 22 says, "Thus did Noah according to all that God commanded him, so did he." This is a wonderful statement about Noah. Noah did according to all that God commanded him. So did he. Noah was a man of strong faith in God's word, but faith without works is dead, we know. So Noah also had absolute obedience to that word. The commands given to Noah required him to do some monumental jobs, extremely difficult and discouraging, and yet Noah never questioned or complained. He simply obeyed. Noah could have very easily gotten discouraged. He could have very easily begun to question just why is all this required to be done here. He couldn't see any real need for it, as no other person could. But the faith said, "Yes, Noah, this needs to be done." The last verse of the 6th chapter, verse 22, simply summarizes in a very clear manner a whole century of God's long-suffering while Noah preached righteousness to those who were disobedient while the ark was preparing, according to 1 Peter 3:20, 2 Peter 2:6, and Luke 17, 26 and 27. And not only in this verse, but three times more are we told that Noah did all that God commanded him, Genesis 7, 5, 9, and 16. Noah was probably not a giant physically, but he was one spiritually. Noah was indeed a giant in the earth in those days, and the world has possibly never seen his equal since. Because Noah walked with God and was obedient to his faith in God's word, God had a close and marvelous fellowship with Noah. There are 7 recorded occasions in which it is said that God spoke to Noah. Genesis 6:13, 7:1, 8:15, 9:1, 8, 12, and 17. And each time they were fellowship and blessing to Noah and his family. In contrast, in Psalm 29, which deals with the great flood, 7 times the voice of the Lord thunders forth in majesty and judgment before a world that had rejected him. Psalm 29, verses 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, and 9. These are very likely a type of the 7 thunders and their voices, which, though uttered in future judgment, are not to be revealed in detail until that future time comes, Revelation 10, 3 through 4. Now let's take a look at the physical world before the great flood. We've shown that the spiritual life of humankind had fallen to very low and deplorable states in the world before the flood. The world was destroyed by the great flood to wipe out this state of spiritual depravity on the part of man. But this great flood also destroyed the physical, natural world which existed then, and the physical world has never been the same. Let us look briefly at the physical characteristics of the world before the flood. What a marvelous world this must have been. Even in our imagination, we are not able to reconstruct for ourselves a picture of the world which God had given as a possession to Adam and his descendants. The world of Adam, Methuselah, Enoch, and Noah was a wondrous world. A world rich in plant and animal life, much more than we have today. A world which yielded fruit of every kind for man and beast without any kind of effort on the part of either. A world which could therefore support a population many times greater than our present population. A world which was made delightful by a uniform climate of spring-like loveliness, like that of paradise itself. The climate was an ideal climate which prevailed continuously over the whole globe. In short, the whole world was a garden of God, compared with the world which followed. This was the golden age in the history of the earth. It was a creation of God's love, created for the enjoyment of Him who was created in His own image and made to rule over it and possess it. Yet it was that world which was destroyed by the flood. God Himself destroyed it because of man's rejection of God. Our world today is but a shadow of that which was. Our God is a God of love, of tender mercies and long-suffering, to them that fear and love Him and do according to His commandments. But He's a terrible judge to those that reject His mercy. If He spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down into hell, and if He spared not this magnificent world of His own creation, how will the ungodly and the wicked of today escape His wrath when the day of judgment shall dawn upon this second world? In Genesis chapter 7 and 8, we have the story of the great flood. And before we talk about the flood, let's look briefly at the last days of the old world. God had spoken to Noah nearly 100 years earlier, giving instructions concerning the ark and the animals, and assuring him that the flood would come on schedule. We have no record of any further word from heaven, but Noah had continued without hesitation and faithfully with his strange work and ministry, obeying God's commands without question. With all the persuasion at his command, he preached the coming judgment, but to no avail as far as converts were concerned. Finally, the ark was completed, and all the animals were assembling. The 120 years would be up in a few days, and his grandfather Methuselah, who had served the Lord longer than any man who had ever lived, was about to die. Then it was, after a century of no recorded message from God, that God spake to Noah once again. Noah had faithfully followed God's commands. Noah had prepared an ark to the saving of his house, according to Hebrews 11, verse 7. So as we begin the seventh chapter of Genesis, verse 1 says, And the Lord said unto Noah, Come thou and all thy house into the ark. For thee have I seen righteousness before me in this generation. Because Noah had demonstrated faith, Hebrews 11, 7, in God's word, making his faith known by not faltering and obeying God's commandments, God saw or counted him as righteous and saved both him and his house. It's important that God said, Come into the ark, not go. God would be in the ark with them. And although the flood would soon be unleashed in devastating fury, they were all safe with him in the ark. Even though it was because of Noah's faith and obedience that God gave the promise concerning his house, even so, each member of that household also demonstrated saving faith as well. Each one chose to voluntarily enter the ark and leave the world in which they had lived for so long. Noah was most likely a man of great wealth, with his long life and being able to finance the building of the ark, but he and his sons and their wives willingly left it all behind because of their faith that God would perform what He promised. There's a balance between man's free choice and God's saving grace, which the limited understanding of man can never fully comprehend, but both man's choice and God's electing grace have a part in man's salvation. God promised Noah that his family would be saved, chapter 6, 18. Long before they voluntarily chose to enter the ark, chapter 7, 7. But when the time came to make the choice, they did choose correctly, and we have a very similar choice to make for ourselves today. It's simply a matter of knowing what God's will is and then carrying out the command of God, just like Noah did. So verses 2 and 3 of Genesis 7 say, Of every clean beast shalt thou take to thee by sevens, the male and his female, and of beasts that are not clean by two, the male and his female. Of fowls also of the air by sevens, the male and the female, to keep seed alive upon the face of the earth. Immediately after telling Noah the time had come, God instructed him to take seven of each clean animal, along with the pairs of all the others, onto the ark, to keep the seed alive upon the face of all the earth, he says. The purpose stated here was very valid if this were to be a universal flood. But if only a local or partial flood, there would be no good reason to give these instructions to Noah. Any flood less than a universal flood would not threaten the life of the seed upon the face of all the earth. The clean animals included some beasts and birds, but no creeping thing. Probably the clean animals were those suitable for domestication and to be a helper to man, and also acceptable for sacrificial offerings to worship God and provide atonement for man. The three pairs would allow greater numerical proliferation of the clean animals after the flood. To be numerically even with man and his three surviving families, this would also allow for a greater variety of genetic factors, so that more varieties could be developed later as needed. The seventh animal in each group was clearly intended for sacrificial purposes, chapter 8, verse 20. Much later, the law of Moses plainly told which animals were to be regarded as clean in the Israelite system, Leviticus 11 and so forth. But we learned that all such distinctions were to be removed altogether in the Christian dispensation, Acts 10, 9-15, and 1 Timothy 4, verse 4. Verses 4 and 5 of chapter 7 say, "For yet 7 days, and I will cause it to rain upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and every living substance that I have made will I destroy from off the face of the earth. And Noah did according to all that the Lord commanded him." God next tells Noah that it would still be 7 days before the flood would actually come upon the earth. This was probably for all of Noah's last-minute preparations, the placing of the animals in their stalls, feeding them and so forth, and probably one last warning to the world of the ungodly. God assured Noah, though, that after the 7 days, a tremendous rain would fall on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights until every living substance was destroyed from off the face of the earth. A worldwide rain lasting 40 days and 40 nights would be quite impossible under present atmospheric conditions. So this phenomenon required a completely different source of atmospheric waters than our present atmosphere has. We've already seen this source of water to be the waters above the firmament, the vast thermal blanket of invisible water vapor that maintained the greenhouse effect in the world before the flood. These waters above the firmament were somehow to condense and fall on the earth. God also revealed that everything on the dry land that had life would be literally wiped out from the face of the ground. This was to be no small matter. The earth was to be completely cleansed of its corruption in this global bath from heaven. The words here translated every living substance are kol-yeyum, K-O-L-Y-E-Y-U-M, and mean literally all existence, or all that grows up. This concept does not limit itself to merely everything with the breath of life, but it seems to include plants as well as animals. The ground was to be so covered with water and devastated as to be made literally barren of vegetation. The lush forests and meadows of the world before the flood were all to be uprooted and washed away, and either to be buried in the sediments, where they would one day become the coal beds of the post-flood world, or else just decay and go back to dust. When God finished his instructions, Noah proceeded to do all that God commanded him. Just as he had done for over 100 years, here was the final test, the complete break with the world he had known all of his life, thrusting himself completely on God's mercy, and so again Noah obeyed without a shadow of hesitation. Verses 6 through 9 say, "And Noah was 600 years old when the floodwaters was upon the earth. And Noah went in, and his sons, and his wife, and his sons' wives with him, into the ark because of the waters of the flood. Of clean beasts, and of beasts that are not clean, and of fowls, and of everything that creepeth on the earth, there went in two and two into Noah, into the ark, the male and the female, as God had commanded Noah." The authors of this portion of Genesis, probably the sons of Noah, pause to clarify some of the facts of this solemn occasion, placing emphasis on Noah's age at this time. This date brought to an end the pre-flood age of the earth, and began the post-flood age of the earth. And although the flood had not yet begun, the entrance of Noah's family and the animals into the ark cut them off once and for all from the world outside. From that moment on, the new order had begun for all those who had faith in the teaching and promise of God and acted on that belief. Very solemnly, in order to emphasize that every one of God's commandments were being carried out to the very letter, the record clearly describes all who entered the ark: Noah, his sons, his wife, his sons' wives, the clean animals, the unclean animals, the birds, and the creeping things. These were the ones which God had instructed Noah about, and all were now on the ark as planned. Each kind of animal was represented by a male and a female, so that the created kind could be preserved through the flood. Of each clean animal, there were two additional pairs, and an extra individual for sacrificial purposes. Everything had been done as commanded, and the narrative here documents the same. Verses 10 through 12 say, "And it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were upon the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened, and the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. The last grace period of 7 days had ended, and the time of the judgment had arrived. All the preparations for the flood were completed. The exact date was recorded, the second month, the 17th day of the month. And the date of the flood makes us wonder what calendar was in use. But it's probably impossible for us to be sure exactly what date this was. It may be that the measurement of time with this calendar began with creation. If so, the record here would be telling us that the flood came on earth 1,655 years, 1 month, and 16 days after creation. However, this is not something we can be sure of, but we can be sure that this account stresses that on a certain particular day, which marked the end of the pre-flood world, that on that one day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up and the windows of heaven were opened." It is very evident that the geophysical implications of this event are enormous, and it's vital to both the scientific and biblical understanding of Earth's history that we know what these statements mean. We've already seen that the water cycle before the flood was very different from the water cycle of the present day. Genesis 1, 6 through 8, 2 verse 5, 10 through 14, and 5 verse 5. The water cycle before the flood seems to have been controlled by two great reservoirs of water, which resulted from the great separation of the waters of the deep on the second day of creation into the waters above the firmament and the waters below the firmament. The firmament, which separated these two bodies of water, was the atmospheric heavens. The water above the firmament, also called waters above the heavens in Psalms 148, verse 4, these waters made up the vast vaporous canopy, which maintained the earth as a beautiful greenhouse, preventing cold temperatures and therefore preventing rain and windstorms. Being in the vapor state, it was invisible and completely transparent, but nevertheless, it contained vast quantities of water which could have extended far out into space. The waters below the firmament became what is referred to as the great deep or the great depth of water. This was water in the liquid state. This was visible to the first men as seas, Genesis 1:10, and rivers, Genesis 2:10-14. These rivers were not produced by runoff from rainfall, Genesis 2:5, but they came from controlled fountains or springs, evidently from deep-seated sources in or below the earth's crust. Proverbs 8:24 and Job 38:16 seem to refer to these fountains of the great depths. Such subterranean reservoirs were apparently all interconnected with each other, as well as with the surface seas into which the rivers drained, so that the entire complex constituted one great deep. The energy for repressuring and recycling the waters must have come from the earth's own subterranean heat placed there at creation. The entire system must have been a marvelous heat engine which would have operated indefinitely as long as the earth's internal heat lasted, as long as the system of reservoirs, valves, governors, and conduits maintained their structure. Experts in the field of hydraulics and thermodynamics say that such a system is very feasible, and we know there is no reason to question the Creator's ability to provide this type of a system for the world He made. When the time for the destruction of the world arrived, all that was required was to bring the two deeps together again, as they had been when first created. The waters above the firmament must be condensed and be precipitated, and the waters below the crust must burst their bounds and escape again to the surface. Exactly how God brought about the great flood has been the cause for wide speculation among many students of the Bible. All sorts of catastrophes have been suggested. Sudden tiltings of the earth's axis,
bombardment of the Earth by meteorites or asteroids, a sudden slipping of the Earth's crust, nuclear explosions caused by alien space travelers, gravitational and electromagnetic forces caused by a near miss of a wandering planet or comet, and many other theories. However, as we study the workings of God, we see that He has created a universe which is highly efficient in operation, and He will not interfere in this operation supernaturally unless the natural principles are incapable of accomplishing His purpose in a given situation. We should bear this in mind as we attempt to explain the cause of the Great Flood. There is no question that God could have caused all the events of the Great Flood miraculously, but scientific understanding of natural laws shows us that God could have started the reaction which caused the flood with some minor changes in nature's balance. The Bible states that the flood was caused by the bursting of the fountains of the great deep and the pouring down of torrential rains from heaven. These two events are sufficient in themselves to explain the flood and its effects without the need for supernatural creative miracles. The breaking up, or literally the cleaving open, of the fountains of the deep is mentioned first, and so this was evidently the first action which triggered the rest. These underground conduits somehow all developed uncontrollable fractures on the same day. For such a remarkable worldwide phenomenon, there must have been a worldwide cause. The most likely cause would seem to have been a rapid buildup and surge of intense pressure throughout the underground system, and this in turn would most likely cause a rapid rise in pressure throughout the entire system. God could have easily caused a miraculous upset in the balance of this great underground system to start a chain reaction and bring about a sequence of events which the Bible describes. And as we look at these great events described here in the Bible and see how they could have come about in a most natural way, it even strengthens more our belief in the story given in Genesis. That's our lesson. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.
I'm satisfied with just the cottage below, a little silver and a little gold. But in that city where the ransom will shine, I want a gold one, that silver line. I've got a mansion just over the hilltop in that bright hamlet. We'll never grow old, and someday yonder we will never more wander or walk the streets that are pure as gold. Don't think me forlorn, is that it all lonely? I'm not discouraged, I'm in love. I'm just a pilgrim in search of a city. I want a mansion, a robe and a crown. I got a mansion just over the hilltop in that bright hamlet. We'll never grow old.
question, O Father, how long?